Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, February 24th on Iris. I'm your reader, Aaron. Our first article on the front page, Band Festival to return this year. 2020 was first year without North Iowa Band Fest since World War II by Ashley Stewart, Globe Gazette. A longtime music tradition that showcases local and regional musicians will return to downtown Mason City this year. The 82nd annual North Iowa Band Festival will take place Memorial Day weekend on May 27th through the 30th. First, after the Mason City Park and Recreation Board approved the event's facility request, among others, during a special meeting Friday evening. Quote, at this point, we're planning to have everything and figuring out ways to do it safely, end quote, said Robin Anderson, Mason City Area Chamber of Commerce President and CEO. Quote, hopefully people will continue to get vaccinated and wear masks, among other things, so that we can have a band festival that everybody can feel good about, end quote. The five-day event, which honors the late Meredith Wilson, was canceled for the first time since World War II in 2020 due to health concerns related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Wilson, a Mason City native best known for his songwriting on the popular Broadway's musical The Music Man and instilling a rich musical heritage in the city, died in 1984. The theme of the canceled 2020 Band Festival, Band Fest on Broadway, was a nod to the Broadway revival of the musical featuring Hugh Jackman as Professor Harold Hill. Anderson said the North Iowa Band Festival Committee planned to reuse the theme for the 2021 event and continue its efforts to lure Jackman to Mason City to be the event's honorary grand marshal while Broadway performances were on hold. But because of Broadway reopening schedule and the unlikeliness of Jackman's visit, she said staff proposed a new theme. The festival's theme this year will be banding together and marching forward. Quote, everybody liked the play on words as well as the sentiment of kind of getting through this all together, end quote, she said. As for this year's Grand Marshal, Anderson said the announcement will be made on April 1. Troy Levinghagen, Mason City Park and Recreation Board Chair, said the board convened in special session to address several times sensitive facility requests Friday, including the one from the North Iowa Band Festival. The park board, comprising five members, approved the request with the stipulation that if Cerro Gordo sees a significant increase in active COVID-19 cases increase around the time of the event, it has the discretion to reconsider its request, he said. Anderson said the committee is working closely with city staff to ensure the festival is safe for all those involved because, quote, no one wants to put on a super spreader event, end quote. One big change to this year's band festival, she said, is that band festival parade participants won't be allowed to pass out anything like candy, flyers, and trinkets to spectators. The carnival, live entertainment, and Stu Neverman run are scheduled to take places as planned, she said. For more information about the North Iowa Band Festival parade schedule and entertainment, visit www.nibandfest.com. Our next front page article, Grab and Give Yields Hefty Haul for Hawkeye Harvest. Teams compete to buy items for food bank by Lisa Gruet, Globe Gazette. Dozens of participants took to the aisles of Hy-Vee West in Mason City Tuesday morning, speedily stuffing shopping carts with food and household supplies during the Farm Bureau Grab and Give event. Similar to the game show, quote, supermarket sweep, end quote, the three heat relay race saw teams representing area businesses and organizations running throughout the store, searching for as many non-perishable food items and essentials as they could. The objective of the race is for each team to keep the total dollar amount they spend as close to $250 as possible. The winning team takes home bragging rights and a shopping cart trophy full of candy, but since all the teams purchased are donated to the Hawkeye Harvest Food Bank, some of the teams work toward a different goal, purposely losing by spending as much as they can. This year's cart went to Thornton-based North Iowa Cooperative. Team members Abby Servants, Sarah Sturgis, and Brent Osborne racked up $249.64 in merchandise for their first win in the decade they've participated. After several years of lingering in the top five finishers, the trio said they went in with a plan. Quote, this year, we were really strategizing because our general manager told us that we needed to win, Sturgis laughed. We studied the Hy-Vee yesterday at work, figuring out what the best deals were, end quote. quote, Osborne joked that he hopes their boss will reward their win with pay raises. Overall, the group was just glad to be there. Quote, we're just happy to be able to give to the Hawkeye Harvest Food Bank and give back to the community, end quote, Cerverance said. Our last front page article, Board Moves to Protect Watershed, Cerro Gordo County Officials Aim to Improve Shell Rock River Area, by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. Tuesday morning's meeting of the Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors was a day for significant financial measures as well as possible structural improvements, along with approving a capital loan refunding plan that could mean $231,000 in interest savings. The three-member panel signed off on a resolution which will help create the, quote, Shell Rock River Watershed Management Coalition, end quote. According to Cerro Gordo County Conservation Board Executive Director Mike Webb, part of the purpose for the agreement is to improve food mitigation, flood mitigation for towns and counties up and down the river. Quote, it gives them a way to source outside funding to mitigate flooding and improve water quality, end quote, Webb said of the plan. Webb said that Cerro Gordo has asked to join the coalition because towns within the county, such as Plymouth and Rock Falls, are along the Shell Rock River. To represent Cerro Gordo's interests, the county board unanimously approved making Webb a delegate to the newly minted coalition. At the previous week's board meeting, the Cerro Gordo County Supervisors moved forward on a plan to refund 2012 capital loan notes it used to cover costs for the county's law enforcement center. On Tuesday, Casey Callanan, the county board's chair, was authorized to sign a final term sheet with MBT Bank, which operates in Clear Lake. Under the terms, Cerro Gordo is expected to see at least $231,000 in savings over a multi-year period. Through the refunding process, Cerro Gordo received three bids from local banks. MBT's low bid totaled $4,573,000 and had a rate of 0.399%. The savings are subsequent enough that county officials expect to see results from the deal within the next year. Quote, we have been working on our budget for 22 and we will see some savings in our debt service levy and be able to drop that levy even more for the taxpayer, end quote, Cerro Gordo County Budget Manager Heather Mathurey said. The other big-ticket financial item for the Board of Supervisors came with approval of a, quote, community development block grant, end quote, agreement with YSS Finance Francis Luer, which will help with its multi-million dollar renovation project. Francis Luer's community-based center director, Shonda Hansen, said previously that the $600,000 agreement, which includes the county, the regional North Iowa Area Council of Governments, and the state of Iowa, will go toward work on the group's crisis intake center, school, dining facilities, and outpatient facilities. As the meeting came to a close, CG Public Health Director Brian Hanfit updated the Board of Supervisors about where COVID-19 vaccination efforts are at now. According to Hanfit, next week's allocation of vaccines will be 800 doses. He said the pace that Cerro Gordo has maintained means that about 28% of residents 65 and older have been vaccinated. Quote, at this rate, it's going to take a while, end quote, Hanfit said. Hanfit then relayed that the county has tried to push more weekly doses of COVID-19 vaccine, but that the state has yet to up the allotment. That decision means that county health officials will have to carefully assess when it can begin vaccinations for food and manufacturing workers and how many vaccines it can offer to them on a weekly basis. Our next article, Mason City Fire Department confirms fatality in Monday night house fire, Globe Gazette staff. A Monday night structure fire at the Gracious Estates mobile home community on Mason City's East End that had firefighters on scene for several hours has resulted in one death. The confirmation came Tuesday afternoon from Mason City Deputy Fire Chief Jamie Medlin, who wrote in a press release that, quote, release of victim's name will be made by the Mason City Police Department pending notification of family members, end quote. Medlin then noted that the apparent cause of the fire is, quote, smoking material, end quote. Based on the timeline provided in the release, a call for the fire went out at 8:53 p.m. and firefighters were at Gracious Estates until 1:47 a.m. Car accident sends one to hospital in Mason City. An accident involving two vehicles sent one person to the hospital for their injuries in Mason City on Tuesday afternoon, according to a press release from the Cerro Gordo County's Sheriff's Office. Quote, 25-year-old Dustin Fratsky of Mason City was southbound on Thrush Avenue in a Hewitt hauling garbage truck attempting to turn east on 200th Street when 44-year-old Alice Hearn of Dumont attempted to overtake the garbage truck in her 2009 Ford F-150, end quote. The Cerro Gordo Sheriff's Department responded to the report at about 2:07 p.m. Hearn was later transported to Mercy One at North Iowa for her injuries. Both drivers were wearing their seatbelts, the press release noted. Also assisting at the scene were the Iowa State Patrol, Iowa Vehicle Enforcement, Rockwell Fire Department, Rockwell Swaddale, EMTs, and Mason City Fire Medics. As of Tuesday afternoon, the accident is under investigation with charges pending. Unions, jobless benefit changes are attack on Iowa workers by James Q. Lynch, special to the Globe Gazette, Des Moines. Changes to state unemployment benefits will be bad for Iowa workers and bad for Iowa. Labor union members argued the morning after an Iowa House committee approved modifications Republicans said would improve the long-term viability of the unemployment trust fund. Quote, this legislation is an attack on all working people and it's an attack on our local economy, and quote, Scott Putney of Council Bluffs said Tuesday during a virtual news conference. Quote, the money that people get from unemployment, they're spending it immediately on things they need, food, clothing for their families. So this money is going right back into the economy, end quote. Putney was among labor union members who spoke against House Study Bill 203, which was approved on a party line vote after more than 5 hours of sometime testy and emotional debate Monday night. The changes have been proposed but not adopted in previous years. Majority Republicans plan to proceed with the bill this year, but delay its implementation until July 1, 2022. By then, Labor Committee Chairman Dave DeRoy, Republican of Nevada, said the coronavirus pandemic is expected to be over and Iowa workforce development should have completed the replacement of its, quote, creaky old computer system, end quote. HSB 203 would require workers to wait a week after being laid off before being eligible unemployment benefits, reduce the benefit amount paid to workers with multiple dependents, and cut worker benefits by 13 weeks in the case of business closure. Although the unemployment trust fund is healthy, DOI said there is a concern that without changes, the balance may, over time, be depleted. The fund has had about $1.5 billion in claims in the past year, he said. During that time, Iowa employers paid about $400 million into the fund, and Governor Kim Reynolds transferred $499 million of Federal CARES Act money to it. Iowa's economy generally has been strong over the past 10 years, and no increase in the rates employers pay into the unemployment fund is anticipated, DeRoy said. However, the unemployment tax rates have not fallen as low as expected. Quote, generally in the past, they would have gone down to the lowest tax rate, end quote, he said. Democrats and unions say Republicans are taking marching orders from its business community campaign contributors, making changes at the expense of Iowa workers. Quote, lost in all of the talk about tax tables and how this state can apparently continue to line the pockets of big businesses in is the human impact that being on unemployment brings, end quote, said Charlie Wishman, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. With Labor Committee passage, HSB 203 has cleared a deadline to remain alive for consideration by the full House. DOI doesn't know when that will happen. A companion bill, SSB 1172, has cleared a Senate Labor and Business Relations subcommittee. Moving to the opinion page, fair trial will be challenged for a Minneapolis cop by DJ Tice. In December, the Hennepin County District Court made public a questionnaire it was sending to prospective jurors in the upcoming murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin to imagine giving honest answers to the court's lengthy list of queries posed, the court explains, in hopes the written exam will, quote, help to shorten the jury selection process, end quote, is to understand why it might just take a little time to find impartial and unintimidated jurors for this case in this community. Justice for all can exist only if, even if the most disturbing cases, when popular passions burn hottest, criminal conviction requires that the specific criminal nature of individual conduct is proven conclusively. That is not guaranteed, even in this case. At one point, the court's juror questionnaire for this case asks, quote, under our system of justice, defendants are presumed innocent of the criminal charges against them. Would you have any difficulty following this principle of law? End quote. From the moment this agonizing incident burst into the public's consciousness, the presumption of guilt regarding these defendants, the open and shut conclusion of guilt, has been loudly declared by virtually every prominent public official who has addressed the matter. On May 27, 2020, a day and a half after Floyd's death, and before much of anything was known about the incident beyond the initial disturbing video of Chauvin pinning a handcuffed Floyd to the pavement, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey demanded that prosecutors file criminal charges against the officers he had quickly fired. Quote, why is the man who killed George Floyd not in jail? Frey protested. If you had done it or I had done it, we would be behind bars right now. We cannot turn a blind eye. I saw no threat. End quote. Governor Tim Walz made comparable pronouncements in the early days, and in the middle of June, he traveled to Duluth to commemorate the 100th anniversary of one of Minnesota's most shameful crimes, the lynching of three black circus workers from a downtown lamppost by a mob of thousands that had rushed to judgment over dubious allegations of rape. Quote, there is an unbroken line between what happened on that street corner 100 years ago, right to George Floyd's murder on the streets of Minneapolis, end quote, Walz declared. Walz and Frey were joined in rushing to proclaim guilt in this instance by both of Minnesota's U.S. senators, then Minneapolis police chief and state public safety commissioner, city council members, and on and on and on. Walz has now mobilized the guard to reinforce the Minneapolis police out of concern that Chauvin's trial could incite unrest. Suffice it to say that much of our community, far from presuming the innocence of these defendants, may have been left unprepared to peacefully entertain even if it's possibility. Of course, all the presumptions of guilt are chiefly based on the bystanders' cell phone recordings of Chauvin kneeling on the side of a handcuffed Floyd's neck for close to 10 minutes. We would be in a safer situation if the general public better understood that defense attorneys can and will raise questions about whether this painful image captured a deliberate and heinous criminal act that unambiguously caused Floyd's death. Voluminous public filings reveal numerous not ridiculous disputes that may arise at trial. First, there is the question whether the awful-looking restraint maneuver Chauvin used was actually authorized at the time, or at least not clearly forbidden. In the wake of Floyd's death, both the Minneapolis City Council and the state legislature moved to decisively outlaw police use of chokeholds. The length of time Chauvin persisted in kneeling on Floyd's neck, despite pleas from bystanders and concerned questions from his fellow officers, will likely be key in the case against him. But a jury may be asked to also ponder this. If the tactic Chauvin used was already a crime when he used it, why was there such a rush to change policies and laws to forbid chokeholds immediately afterward? As the court's juror questionnaire puts it in another of its queries, quote, under our system of justice, the prosecution has the burden of proving the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Would you have any difficulty following this principle of law? End quote. When a legal proceeding is as emotionally supercharged as this one and has taken on such enormous symbolic significance, leaders of the community would seem to have a particular duty to urge the public to remain calm and patient, to respect the processes of law, and to withhold final judgment until all the facts and arguments from all sides have been fairly examined. It is terribly late for that message to be delivered in this situation, but late would be better than not at all. Again, that opinion came from DJ Tice, who is a commentary editor and an opinion columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Our next opinion, bill to constrain absentee voting speeds forward by Aaron Murphy. A wide-ranging bill that would dramatically alter the shape of Iowa's elections could go from public interdiction to state law in a little more than a week. Hey, who says the gears of government grind slowly? It's inspiring to know that state lawmakers are capable of acting swiftly when the spirit so moves. There are times when the needs are critical and rapid action is required by the legislator. This, unfortunately, is not one of those times. The elections bill would make many significant changes to Iowa's elections system, which in 2020 produced the state's highest ever voter turnout. If the bill is passed into law, Iowa's early voting period would become one of the shortest in the country, and county election officials would have fewer options for expanding early and absentee voting. In other words, the very tools that helped produce Iowa's most successful election would be significantly constrained or even eliminated. Republicans who have introduced the legislation are arguing their case, and the changes are needed to ensure Iowa's elections remain safe and secure and to ensure elections are operated the same across all of the state's 99 counties. That's an argument they should have to continue to make to Iowans for longer than a week. The legislation was introduced on January 16th, less than 24 hours later. It was passed out of subcommittees in both the House and Senate. Roughly 24 hours later after that, it was passed out of full committees in both chambers. It was slated for Senate floor debate on Tuesday, which means it could be on the governor's desk by the end of the week. These proposed changes are not nibbling around the edges. These would, in many ways, reshape how Iowa elections are run. It's fine to present such a proposal, but the public deserves to have time to digest everything that's in the bill and provide feedback to their state House representatives, especially given the gravity of the legislation. A little more than a week is not sufficient time for the conservation that should be had over this kind of legislation. The public had a chance to offer input. A public hearing was held on Monday. That was a step in the right direction. But with a bill like this, it would behoove state lawmakers to exercise some restraint, give the public time to learn about this proposal, and provide feedback for or against. That would be good governance, something legislators should always strive for, especially when it pertains to legislation like this. Again, that opinion came from Aaron Murphy, who covers Iowa politics and government for Lee Enterprises. And our last opinion, renewable energy capable of powering through cold by Libby Jacobs. The latest winter blast in Iowa and many parts of the country is a rare extreme weather event resulting in spikes in energy demands. Conditions including loss of access to heat or electricity in the bitter cold for hours or days for millions of individuals and families in Texas are serious and disturbing emergencies. The harsh weather amid a pandemic is creating further hardship for many. Here in Iowa, over 5,000 Iowans lost power during 30 below wind chills. It is crucial during times of crisis to maintain perspective and focus on the facts. Some reports regarding the situation in Texas have alluded to renewable energy as part of the problem. Whether the origin of this type of suggestion is politically or otherwise motivated is not important and is better set aside during crisis times. Though my many years of public service as a legislator and utility regulator, I know the importance of acting swiftly to help those with immediate and significant needs. This should be followed by seeking to gain a measured, complete, and clear understanding of the situation. This information, combined with the background knowledge of facts about the industries, technologies, and providers, equip decision makers with the essential tools needed to mitigate and plan for the issues in the future. In Iowa, thanks to its bipartisan leadership in renewable energy over many years under the tutelage of several visionary governors, Senator Grassley, and other elected officials, we know firsthand that wind turbines provide homes and businesses with power throughout the cold winter months, including extreme weather condition. Iowa leads the nation with 53% of its electricity generated by renewable energy. Like Iowa, cold weather states such as Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota each generate more than 20% of electricity using renewable energy. The Midwest, known to experience brutally cold weather, comprises prime wind energy states. Preventative measures to keep wind turbines operating in cold weather are a standard practice in climates like the Midwest, but have not been necessary for Texas, given its typically mild winters. As we expand our electric grid system in a accompanying infrastructure, renewable energy can meet the demand for increased electricity capacity during extreme weather conditions. The build out of the nation's transmission lines, much like that of the interstate system, combined with weatherproofing, will be key to weathering the storm more safely in the future. Data on the record-breaking cold snap across the U.S. shows states with greater regional transmission connectivity, such as Iowa, held up better than most, showcasing the importance of solid infrastructure and geographical reach. At the end of the day, renewable energy performed as the scenario modeling expected, and providers are doing all they can to help keep the lights on and keep their communities warm. Renewable energy is a strong resource for Iowa and for the nation, now and into the future. And that opinion came from Libby Jacobs, who was an Iowa state representative from 1995 to 2008, an Iowa Utilities Board member from 2011 to 2017, and is president of the Jacobs Group, LLC. For our political cartoon today, we have two people driving. It looks like a man and a woman. The man has a hat on and he is driving, and we're looking from behind the car, so we don't really see their faces. We just see the back of their heads. And they're not really going anywhere. It doesn't really show that they're going anywhere. The picture is just kind of blank in that sense. But they're listening to the radio, and the man says out loud, "Oh, and the man on the back of his chair, it says the right, and on the back of the woman's chair, it says the left." So the man says, "Let's have a moment of silence for the great Rush Limbaugh," as he turns the radio down and it says click. So I'm assuming he turns off the radio for the moment of silence. And the woman is thinking, she does not say aloud, she has a thought bubble, says, "Or if I can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all." Looking back, today is Wednesday, February 24th, the 55th day of 2021. There are 310 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history: on February 24th, 1868, the U.S. House of Representatives impeached President Andrew Johnson by a vote of 126-47. Following his attempted dismissal of Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, Johnson was later acquitted by the Senate. On this date in 1803, in its Marbury versus Madison decision, the Supreme Court established a judicial review of the constitutionality of statutes. In 1815, American engineer and inventor Robert Fulton, credited with building the first successful commercial steamboat, died in New York at age 49. In 1938, the first nylon Bristol toothbrush, manufactured by DuPont under the name, quote, "Dr. West's Miracle Toothbrush," end quote, went on sale. In 1942, the SS Struma, a charter ship attempting to carry nearly 800 Jewish refugees from Romania to British-mandated Palestine, was torpedoed by a Soviet submarine in the Black Sea. All but one of the refugees perished. In 1961, the Federal Communications Commission authorized the nation's first full-scale trial of pay television in Hartford, Connecticut. In 1981, a jury in White Plains, New York, found Gene Harris guilty of second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of, quote, "Scarsdale's Diet," end quote, author Dr. Herman Tarnover. Sentenced to 15 years in life in prison, Harris was granted clemency by New York Governor Mario Cuomo in December 1992. In 1988, in a ruling that expanded legal protections for parody and satire, the Supreme Court unanimously overturned a $150,000 award that the Reverend Jerry Falwell had won against Hustler magazine and its publisher Larry Flint. In 1989, a state funeral was held in Japan for Emperor Hirohito, who had died the month before at age 87. Moving to the obituaries, Howard Eugene Grimm, November 28, 1934 to January 6, 2021. Howard Eugene Grimm, 86 years young, peacefully passed away on January 6, 2021 at CHI Mercy Hospital in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Howard was born in Wisconsin on November 28, 1934 to Walter and Iola Grimm. He grew up in Kanawha, Iowa. Left to cherish his memory is his wife of 67 years, Dolores Grimm, sons Todd, spouse Tammy Grimm, Tracy, spouse Marcy Grimm, and daughter Sheila, spouse Sheila Gabe, brothers Tom, spouse Sandy Grimm, and Terry, spouse Julie Grimm, and sister Deanna, spouse Jock Stevenson. Howard, a very proud papa, is also survived by grandsons Joshua, spouse Amanda Gabe, Nathan, spouse Allie Grimm, and granddaughters Ashley, spouse Jesse Cruz, Natasha, spouse Ed Gregory, and Asia, spouse Marcus Sheets. Seven precious great-grandchildren and one great-grandchild on the way. Howard is preceded in death by his parents, brother Robert Grimm, and grandson Ethan Grimm. Howard was very passionate about his family. He was a very hard worker and had an even kinder and generous heart. A very heartfelt thank you to the doctors and nurses at Mercy Hospital for their compassionate care in his final days. Howard requested to be cremated with no services due to COVID-19. Howard's family will have a small private celebration of his life. Gregory Allen Keough, K-E-O-U-G-H, Leland. Gregory Allen Keough, 73, of Leland, passed away peacefully Monday, February 22, 2021, at the Hancock County Medical Center in Britt, Iowa. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 27, 2021, at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Forest City, with Pastor Zach Anderson officiating. Masks will be required and social distancing practices are still being encouraged. Greg's service will be streamed live on the Scott Funeral Home's website beginning around 10:30 a.m. on the day of the service. Go to www.schottfuneralhomes.com, click on his photo, and from his obit page, click on quote tribute wall and quote tab to find the webcast link. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 26, 2021 at the Scott Funeral Chapel, 505 North Clark Street, Forest City, Iowa, 50436. Masks will be encouraged and social distancing practices are still being encouraged. Burial will be held in Oakland Cemetery, Forest City, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Gateway Hospice or the donor's choice. You can contact the family with online condolences at www.scottfuneralhomes.com, 641-585-2685. Mary Ann Susan Jensen Green. Private family service for Mary Ann Jensen, 80, of Green, will be Friday, February 26, 2021, at Rest Funeral Home, 519 North 1st Street, Green. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home Thursday night. Marianne Susan Jensen passed away on February 19, 2021 at home with her family by her side. Memorial may be directed to the family P.O. Box 219 Green, Iowa 50636. Services are entrusted to Rest Funeral Home, 519 North 1st Street, Green, at 641-823-4457, www.retsfh.com. Loretta, known as Dolly Johnson, Mason City. Loretta, known as Dolly Johnson, 87, of Mason City, died on Friday, February 12, 2021, at Mercy One Hospice of North Iowa. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, February 27, 2021, at Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. Memorials may be directed to the family of Loretta Johnson. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City, Iowa, 50401. Phone number 641-423-0924, www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. John E. Whitaker. John E. Whitaker, 99, died Tuesday, February 22, 2021, at his home in Osage, graveside interment with Osage American Legion Honor Guard. For John E. Whitaker will be held Friday, February 26, 2021, 11 a.m. at Osage Cemetery. Champion Funeral Home, Osage, 641-732-3706, www.schroederfuneralhomes.com. Paul T. Harabeck. I'm going to spell that Harbachecek, September 13th, 1956 to February 16th, 2021. Paul T. Harabeck, 64, of Mason City, left this earth peacefully to be joined with his parents in heaven on Tuesday, February 16th, 2021, surrounded by family at the Rochester Mayo Hospital. Paul courageously fought a battle with metastatic esophageal cancer since June of 2019. He volunteered for organ donation and an autopsy for cancer research, as well as to help educate medical staff. We are grateful for the benevolent staff at the Mayo Hospital that came to Paul's side throughout the past few years. Paul was born on September 13th, 1956, in Mason City, Iowa. He graduated from Newman Catholic High School in 1974. In his youth, Paul modified a 1969 Plymouth Road Runner that he loved driving and won several drag races with. For 38-plus years, Paul built a successful career in car sales. He is remembered for his integrity and honest, forthright personality, along with a sense of humor that would catch you off guard and leave you with a smirk on your face. He was a well-respected lifelong resident of Mason City. Paul was married to Linda Butler, 1978 through 1981. He married Cheryl Deekhouse, 1985 to 1990, with daughters Pamela and Jennifer. In 1986, Paul and Cheryl celebrated the birth of their daughter, Kelly. At age of 62, Paul retired from the car sales industry but continued his unofficial career as a humorous and lively stand-up comedian and how he interacted with others. In addition to cars, Paul loved hunting, designing, and building things from scratch and sharing his knowledge and abilities, helping others with projects. Paul would tell you his greatest accomplishment was being a father. His daughter Kelly explains that some of his greatest achievements were his unconditional love as a father, compassion for others, hard work ethic, and being a grandpa to her dog Jackson. Family was very important to Paul, whether related by blood or those he considered extended family. He is survived by his daughter Kelly Harabeck and his grand dog Jackson of Plano, Texas, his stepdaughters and their sons, Pamela Dykehouse and son Jameson of Mason City, and Jennifer Mallow, spouse Jay Peterson of Goodell, and son Dylan of Mason City, his brother and sister and their families, Joe Harbeck and wife Teresa and children, Katie and Kyle Harbeck, all from Boise, Idaho, John Harbeck of Mason City and family, Derek Finest and wife Samantha of Mason City, Mindy Winters and husband Matt of Rockford, and children Sydney Shackleton, Caleb Haley, and Alexis Winters, Mary Hodson of Laverne, and children Sarah and husband Nick Davis of St. Louis, Missouri, and Nick Hodson of Laverne, Pat Harbeck of Freeborn, Minnesota, and children Eric and wife Emily Harbeck, and children Ethan and Elena, all of Mason City, and Jennifer Harbeck and children, all of Albert Lee, Minnesota, Lionel Olvida Jr., Janessa Olvida, Desjare, and Darazanen Boatman, his extended family, Bill Jelma and wife Lorraine of Mason City, and children, William and Christina Jelma, Dwayne Hickok, and wife Cheryl Hickok. He was preceded in death by his parents, Leo and Frances Harbeck. Paul showed amazing strength through his battle with cancer. He woke up every day thanking God for another day on this earth. We will honor his legacy with a celebration of life that will be announced at a later date when temperatures are warmer and travel is safer. The family suggests memorials may be directed to the Humane Society of North Iowa, and condolences may be sent to the family at 707 South Fillmore Avenue, Mason City, Iowa, 50401. Moving to the sports page, prep roundup, season ends for Mason City boys. Mohawks fall to Norwalk in Class 4A sub-state tournament by Shane Lance, Globe Gazette. The Mason City boys basketball team saw its season end on Monday night with a 71-62 loss to Norwalk in the first round of Class 4A sub-state 8 tournament. The Mohawks trailed at the half 33-27 and pulled within 3 points after outscoring the Warriors in the third quarter 18-15, but a 23-point offense outburst in the fourth from Norwalk ended Mason City's comeback hopes. Mohawks junior Corey Miner put up a team-high 17 points on Monday, while fellow juniors Isaiah Washington and Carter Thomas scored 15 and 14 points respectively. Quote, "I am super proud of how this team ended the season the last few games, and I can't wait to see how much better we will get in the offseason with every player returning next season," end quote, Mason City head coach Nick Trask said. Quote, "Thanks to all our fans fans that supported us all season, either in person or on the live stream, end quote. Thomas also contributed a team-high 9 rebounds and 8 assists. Norwalk senior Max Jurgensen led the team with 19 points, while senior Cole Trender had a double-double with 14 points and 11 rebounds. With the loss, Mason City ends the season with a 5-17 record, while Norwalk will move on to play Ankeny in the sub-state second round on Friday. Boys basketball, Crestwood 73, Charles City 68. The Charles City boys basketball team lost to Crestwood 73-68 on Monday night in the first round of the Class 3A Substate 3 tournament. The Comets scored 23 points in the first quarter but fell just short of a comeback victory to end its season at 9-13 overall. Crestwood will play Decorah on Thursday in the second round of the Substate tournament. Our last sports article, unsung heroes play major role for Lions. Clear Lake coach calls unhurdled players big key to our success, by Gunnar Davis, Globe Gazette. If you're a basketball fan in North Iowa, you likely know about Carson Toby and Andrew Formank. The two are the leading scorers for a Clear Lake boys basketball team that is ranked number 9 in Class 3A and finished with a regular season record of 19-2. Toby, a junior guard, averages 18.2 points per game, while Formank, a senior forward, averages a double-double this year. But oftentimes, the success of the role players is just as important as the standout players. In fact, Clear Lake head coach Jeremy Ainley's case is pivotal. Quote, "They're going to make or break your season," Ainley said. "They're going to continue to get better, and we need those guys to be a threat scoring-wise and defending-wise. They're obviously a big key to our success this year and in our future," end quote. The Lions were forced to turn to their role players in the first round of the Class 3A postseason against Hampton Dumont Cal on Monday night. With Toby sidelined due to foul trouble early in the second quarter, the Lions needed secondary scorers to help alleviate pressure off Formank. Clear Lake got that help from junior Jager Schmidt and senior Eric Ritter, who finished with 11 points and 10 rebounds and 10 points respectively. Sophomore Trayvon Lubaya even chipped in 7 rebounds and led with 5 assists in the 57-49 victory over the Bulldogs. While Ritter saw time in nearly every game last year coming off the bench, that wasn't the case for Lubia and Schmidt, the two other starters in the lineup. In fact, there's only 4 games of previous varsity experience between the pair. Schmidt played in 4 games off the bench last year, nearly in the season as a sophomore, but was sidelined when he broke his hand. By the time he came back, it was the playoff and too late for him to get back into the swing of things. Quote, "Really, he's a sophomore playing wise because he hasn't played a lot," Ainley said. "So this year he's really grown up as the season has gone on, defends at a high level, but now starting to figure out ways he can score and ways he can be a threat," end quote. In Lubia's case, he wasn't even on the varsity roster last season in his freshman campaign. His goal this season was just to make it on the roster, so he was excited to learn that he would contribute as a starter at the beginning of the season. For him, the biggest difference in the level of play and the level of intensity. With more fans at games, the energy level within the gym is much higher. Playing with Toby and Formank also helps. Quote, "Being on varsity, they make sure to help everyone and they make sure they are able to do their best," end quote, Lubaya said. Throughout the year, Ainley says Schmidt, Lubaya, and other bench players have been finding their footing on the varsity roster. Quote, "Everyone kind of knows that we have our own rules and it doesn't have to be scoring," Lubaya said. "We start, contribute to the team, and we help a lot of with the winning games. Jager on defense, Ritter is important in the paint. Everyone knows their roles and they're not afraid to be embarrassed or to take that role," end quote. With one playoff opponent knocked off, the Lions are looking to advance past another on Thursday night. Clear Lake is hoping to get its first state tournament appearance at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines since 2019, and just the program's second since 1979. If the Lions are to make it, they'll need everybody. Clear Lake plays in the second round of substate against Spencer at 7 p.m. on Thursday at Clear Lake. Our next article, police funding bill raises concerns of state intrusion by Rod Beauchart, special to the Globe Gazette, Des Moines. Legislation intended to, quote, back the blue, end quote, in Iowa by attempting to prevent local entities from, quote, defunding, end quote, police, drew protests of unnecessary state intrusion and concerns over unintended consequences for smaller communities with sharing arrangements during a legislative hearing Monday. Under Senate Study Bill 1203, local government entities would be ineligible to receive any state funds if their elected officials decide to reduce the budget of their law enforcement agencies unless their total budget was reduced by an equal or larger amount, or the city or county provided, quote, sufficient justification, end quote, to the State Department of Management, which would set rules for the new arrangement. Quote, we believe it is an unnecessary intrusion into local government decision-making, end quote, said Robert Palmer, a lobbyist for the Iowa League of Cities. Local budget-making is a core function of local elected officials, Palmer told a three-member Senate State Committee Government Subcommittee, and, quote, our members believe these local decisions need to remain at the local level, end quote. Palmer said the crux of the proposal was not about public safety, but rather attempted to create incentives for retaining expenditure levels not based upon services needed that could run counter to local efforts to save costs, find efficiencies, and lower property tax burdens. Quote, we believe it sets a very bad precedent on setting minimum expenditures and also on a precedent of the state interjecting itself into local government decision-making, end quote, added Palmer, who was one of the only two speakers to address the panel on the bill that had no supporters among the lobbyists registered, opposed, or undecided. Subcommittee Chairwoman Senator Chris Kornmeyer, Republican of LeClaire, said she appreciated the concerns that were expressed, but she pointed to increased crime and police response time in Minneapolis, quote, after they defunded back in December, end quote. She said the objective of the legislation is, quote, to make sure our communities are safe across Iowa, end quote. Republicans on the panel forwarded the bill to the full committee, but Kornmeyer said she expected the issue would see more work to avoid or address unintended consequences. Larry Murphy, a lobbyist for the Urban County Coalition, the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, Linn County, and the city of Cedar Rapids, who previously served as a mayor, supervisor, and state senator, said he has heard concerns from law enforcement agencies and leaders from communities of various population sizes. Quote, this particular piece of legislation has serious constitutional problems, end quote, he said. He noted that Iowa voters approved constitutional amendments granting home rule to cities in 1968 and counties in 1978 to make those kinds of decisions without state interference or oversight. SSB 1203 would hand that off to a non-elected state agency. Quote, I understand some of the driving force on the Protect the Blue or Back the Blue concept, but the danger of legislating to a particular issue like that is some of the unintended consequences, Murphy said. You do not want to be having local governments' hands tied like this, end quote. Our next article, World Food Prize Laureates Ask Biden to Focus on Hunger, by David Pitt, Associated Press, Des Moines, Iowa, AP. A group of 24 scientists, economists, researchers, and other winners of the World Food Prize sent a letter Tuesday to President Joe Biden asking him to focus on alleviating global hunger, poverty, and malnutrition. The World Food Prize Foundation released the letter that describes the United States' involvement in battling global hunger as foundational. Quote, American leadership will be a beacon that helps to light the way and a catalyst for action that gets us to a world in 2030 where we live within our planetary boundaries, everyone is well nourished, and no one goes to bed hungry, end quote, said Lawrence Headed, 2018 World Food Prize laureate and executive director of Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. He said current food systems must improve because they have contributed to rising hunger and have been too slow to reduce child undernutrition. He added that obesity is increasing, biodiversity is being squandered, and community resilience is being undermined. He said it's time for everyone everyone to think and act differently to make a lasting impact. The laureates called on the president to take immediate action by reestablishing American global leadership to end hunger, playing a leadership role in the upcoming UN Food Systems Summit and other global initiatives, refreshing U.S. evidence-based policy and investment to achieve the goal of ending hunger, and expanding the USAID Feed the Future initiatives. Quote, American leadership on getting food systems right will inspire and embolden others to join forces to end hunger, counter climate change, generate jobs, and promote responsible stewardship of the environment, end quote, the letter said. The World Food Prize was created by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Norman Borlaug in 1986 to recognize scientists and others who have improved the quality and availability of food. The $250,000 prize is awarded annually by the Des Moines, Iowa-based World Food Prize Foundation, which gets support from more than 80 companies, foundations, and individuals. The foundation supports the letter, said its president, Barbara Stinson. Akinwumi Adesina, the winner of the 2017 World Food Prize, drew an analogy between the current effort to vaccinate people to protect them amid the global coronavirus pandemic and protecting people from hunger. Quote, for millions of poor people around the world, the risk of dying from hunger is greater than dying from COVID-19. Without food, medicines don't work. Food and nutrition are the vaccines against hunger. Let's vaccinate the world against hunger, end quote, said Adesina, president of the African Development Bank. Moving to the nation and world section, Capitol insurrection, missed intel is blamed. Law enforcement points fingers at each other at Senate hearing by Mary Claire Jolenick, Michael Balsamo, and Lisa Mascaro, Associated Press, Washington. Missed intelligence was to blame for the outmanned Capitol defenders' failure to anticipate the violent mob that invaded the iconic building and halted certification of the presidential election on January 6. The officials who were in charge of security that day said Tuesday in their first testimony on the insurrection. The officials, including the former chief of the Capitol Police, pointed their fingers at various federal agencies and each other for their failure to defend the building as supporters of then-President Donald Trump overwhelmed security barriers, broke windows and doors, and sent lawmakers fleeing from the House and Senate chambers. Five people died as a result of the riot, including a Capitol Police officer and a woman who was shot as she tried to enter the House chamber with lawmakers still inside. Former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund, who resigned under pressure immediately after the attack, and the other officials said they had expected the protests to be similar to two pro-Trump events in late 2020 that were far less violent. Sund said he hadn't seen an FBI field office report that warned of potential violence, citing online posts about, quote, a war, end quote. Sund described a scene as the mob arrived at the perimeter that was, quote, like nothing, end quote, he had seen in his 30 years of policing, and argued that the insurrection was not the result of poor planning by Capitol Police, but of failures across the board. The hearing was the first of many examinations of what happened that day, coming almost 7 weeks after the attack and over a week after the Senate voted to acquit Trump of inciting the insurrection by telling his supporters to, quote, fight like hell, end quote, to overturn his election defeat. The joint hearing, part of an investigation by two Senate committees, was the first time the officials testified publicly about the events of January 6. In addition to Sund, former Senate Sergeant at Arms Michael Stenger, former House Sergeant at Arms Paul Irvine, and Robert Conti, the acting chief of police for the Metropolitan Police Department, testified. Irvine and Stenger also resigned under pressure immediately after the deadly attack. They were Sun's supervisors and in charge of security for the House and Senate. Quote, we must have the facts and the answers are in this room, end quote, Senate Rules Committee Chairwoman Amy Klobuchar said at the beginning of the hearing. The Rules panel is conducting the joint probe with the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Our next article, XSEX pledge big jump in supply. Drug firms say most Americans will get inoculated by summer, by Matthew Perrone and Lauren Niergaard, Associated Press, Washington. COVID-19 vaccine makers told Congress on Tuesday to expect a big jump in the delivery of doses over the coming month, and the companies insisted they will be able to provide enough for most Americans to get inoculated by summer. By the end of March, Pfizer and Moderna expect to have provided the U.S. government with a total of 220 million vaccine doses, up sharply from the roughly 75 million shipped so far. Quote, we do believe we're on track, and quote, Moderna President Stephen Hoge said, outlining ways the company has ramped up production. Quote, we think we're at a very good spot, end quote. That's not counting a third vaccine from Johnson & Johnson that's expected to get a green light from regulators soon. The Biden administration said Tuesday that it expects about 2 million doses of that vaccine to be shipped in the first week, but the company told lawmakers it should provide enough of the single dose option for 20 million people by the end of March. Looking ahead to summer, Pfizer and Moderna expect to complete delivery of 300 million doses each, and J&J aims to provide an additional 100 million doses. That would be more than enough to vaccinate every American adult, the goal set by the Biden administration. Two other manufacturers, Novavax and AstraZeneca, have vaccines in the pipeline and anticipate eventually adding to those totals. Asked pointedly if they face shortages of raw materials, equipment, or funding that would throw off those schedules, all of the manufacturers expressed confidence that they had enough supplies and had already addressed some of the early bottlenecks in the production. The limited supply of the two approved COVID-19 vaccines hampered the pace of vaccinations even before extreme weather delayed the delivery of about 6 million doses. The White House promised on Tuesday that help is on the way. States can expect about 14.5 million doses of the coronavirus vaccine this week, an almost 70% increase in distribution over the past month, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Tuesday. And White House Coronavirus Coordinator Jeff Zients told governors on Tuesday that the number of doses sent directly to pharmacies will increase by about 100,000 this week, Psaki said. The stepped-up efforts come as the COVID-19 death toll in the U.S. surpassed 500,000, far more than any other country. Briefly, Texas. President Joe Biden will visit Texas on Friday as the state begins its recovery from a devastating winter storm that caused serious damage to homes and businesses across the state, the White House said Tuesday. Interior Deb Haaland, President Joe Biden's nominee to head the Interior Department, faced sharp questions from Republicans Tuesday over what several called her, quote, radical ideas that include opposition to fracking and the Keystone XL oil pipeline. If confirmed, Haaland, 60, would be the first Native American to lead a cabinet agency. Racial injustice. Police officers shown on body camera video holding Daniel Prude down naked and handcuffed on a city street last winter until he stopped breathing will not face criminal charges, according to a grand jury decision announced Tuesday. The 41-year-old black man's death last March sparked nightly protests in Rochester. Egypt. The Biden administration on Tuesday told Egypt that human rights will be, quote, central, end quote, to its policy in dealing with the key Arab state and major American partner. The pronouncement came just a week after the administration approved a nearly $200 million missile sale to Egypt, despite concerns about Cairo's jailing of descendants, including American citizens and their families. Canada. President Joe Biden's first meeting with a foreign counterpart since taking office was high on policy and low on pomp Tuesday, as the coronavirus forced him to convene virtually with Canada's Justin Trudeau. Grounded. The Federal Aviation Administration on Tuesday ordered airlines in the United States to ground planes with the type of engine that blew apart after takeoff from Denver this weekend until they can be inspected for stress cracks. Tech firms Russia behind major hack Washington. Leading technology companies said Tuesday that a months-long breach of corporate and government networks was so sophisticated, focusing on labor-intensive, that a nation had to be behind it, with all the evidence pointing to Russia. In the first congressional hearing on the breach, representatives of technology companies involved in the response described a hack of almost breathtaking precision, ambition, and scope. For instance, investigators have estimated that at least 1,000 highly skilled engineers would have been required. U.S. national security officials also say Russia was likely responsible for the breach, and President Joe Biden's administration is weighing punitive measures against Russia for the hack as well as other activities. Moscow has denied responsibility for the breach. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, February 24th on Iris. I'm your reader, Aaron. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day.